Welcome to Tokyo Game Life, a Tokyo-based video game podcast focusing on Nintendo and gaming culture in Japan's capital. Your host, Mono, here to bring you a slice of gaming life from Tokyo. Today, I'm joined by returning guest and indie developer right here in Japan, Chris from Kani Pro Games. And we chat about porting games to the Switch. We talk about the unexpected journey to get his game, Violet Wisteria, from Steam to the Switch and other platforms. In the game section, I take a look at Vanillaware's strategy RPG, Unicorn Overlord, plus a bit of news including the long-awaited return to Kalos. Let's jump right into the feature on porting games to the Switch with Chris from Kani Pro Games. Today's feature is about something very specific, porting games to the Switch. When a dev makes a game and releases it on Steam, how does it find its way to the Nintendo Switch? Well, we're going to find out and also revisit a game that's been discussed many times on the podcast, Violet Wisteria. Joining me is a special guest. So guest, please introduce yourself.
Hi, everyone. I am Chris. I'm the person behind Kani Pro Games, the developer of Violet Wisteria, and I'm back for, I think, maybe the third time on the Tokyo Game Life podcast. So thank you for having me.
Thank you. This is actually your fifth time, believe it or not. We did.
Is that true? Oh, my God.
Yes. Longtime listeners definitely know you. We've done the Digital Games Expo, the Tokyo Game Music Show, Indie Game Development in Japan, and Violet Wisteria. So we're back again talking not just about Violet Wisteria, but also about the porting process of getting it from Steam to the Switch. So longtime listeners have definitely seen the entire process of this game. So it's really exciting. And I might as well start with a vague and broad question. What does it feel like to have your game hit its first anniversary?
I'm not sure. I didn't really feel anything special about it, I guess. I mean, 1 year has passed. The game made a small mark. A few people really got deeply into it, but it did not become a hot seller or anything like that. So for me, I'm really happy that it's out there and that it's done. But I'm really looking forward to getting on consoles and getting our next game further along also.
Right now, the game's reception is sitting at positive on Steam. Did people react to the game the way you imagined?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a game that's going to be the reactions are going to be on the extreme side. You're really going to either like it or you're probably not. You're just going to be annoyed or disgusted with it, I think. And that seems to be what it's like. I mean, I think people, even who are not good at it, can generally appreciate the creativity of the game mechanic. So I would say yes.
Yeah, for maybe if there are some first-time listeners, give us the pitch on Violet Wisteria. What is Violet Wisteria?
Violet Wisteria is meant to be a 2D platformer straight out of 1991. It is old school, not just in its visuals, but in its blueprint. Finite number of lives, finite number of continues. You run out of those and you go back to the beginning. Sega Genesis, TurboGrafx-16. But the gameplay itself implements a unique system. The easiest way to explain it is that you're like playing rock, scissors, paper, but with colors instead of symbols. So the character can attack and she has three types of sword attacks that have color elements on them. And then enemies appear randomly as those colors. So then it's a cycle of which one has to be used on which other color.
I remember you told me that you did plan to release this game on consoles eventually. And now we are only a few days away from it hitting the Nintendo Switch along with PlayStation and Xbox consoles. Walk us through this journey. What was the first step you took to get Violet Wisteria on consoles?
I started looking for publishers that handle indie games. I don't know, maybe found three or four or five and sent out a few emails saying, I've made a game. It's totally complete. It's on Steam. Is this something that you would be interested in helping bring to home consoles? And East Asia Soft basically gave me the first positive response. Initially, they liked it, but they wanted the control scheme to be on the buttons as opposed to using the D-pad with a single attack button, which is actually already there. A lot of people miss this. That control scheme is available in the options. So I explained that to them and they're like, okay, we'll do it. So that was basically how I found the publisher. So that's step one. There are some other steps though.
So you have a publisher that's interested in it, but what are some things you didn't expect?
The issue with Violet Wisteria is that there's a very, very specific control system due to the game mechanic. And the tutorial section tells you, okay, press right and press this button or press the shoulder button and do this. Each platform holder, Nintendo, Sony, and Microsoft, have very specific set words that you can use to describe buttons on their controllers.
Oh, interesting.
And it absolutely must match or they'll get rejected. Already having the game completely in place, 3 control types and 5 languages, I had to go in and redo all of this to make sure that it switched the button naming depending on which OS it's detected, because it'll detect which console is being played on. So that took a long time. It seems like a small thing, but it was just an absolute headache.
Can you give me an example of some of the terminology, maybe for the Nintendo Switch?
Probably can't say D-pad. I can't remember exactly what it was, but like there's very specific things. Like the D-pad is like has a specific word on every console. You can't say like press or something like this. It's incredibly specific.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it's mad. And it's like, well, I kind of realize now why a lot of games don't really have very clear instructions in the options. Or what they tend to do now is they'll show within the tutorial text, they'll show you a picture of the button instead of saying a button name. And then you can just flip out the images depending on the OS, which is a lot easier.
You self-published Violent Wisteria on Steam. Were you a bit hesitant of getting a publisher for the console releases? Or did you think, in order to get it on consoles, I definitely need a publisher?
Yeah, there's no way I can do that by myself. Nintendo and the Switch, I think, are the most open. I think the bar to entry is the lowest for becoming a registered developer. You need to be registered with them in order to publish games on their platform. And that's also part of the porting process. Generally, these game development softwares have things called codecs that allow you to export the game program into format that that console reads. But you need to basically sign in or have some kind of ID number to export to those consoles. So, you know, if I really wanted to go wild, I could probably figure out a way to become a Switch developer. But the other is you have to have an LLC. You do have to have a company, I think, for the PlayStation. So to get it on all consoles, I would definitely need a publisher.
Since you're based in Japan, were there any advantages or disadvantages to that? For example, is it easier to find a publisher if you're over here in Japan?
I don't know if being physically present in Japan made any issue of it. You know, I mean, I can communicate in writing in both English and Japanese, so that does help. I did try contacting at least one Japanese publisher. It didn't work out, but I'm not sure. I personally don't think so. The issue is, how are you going to get the word out? And I guess we live in a world where it shouldn't drastically affect your ability to do that, depending on which country you live in, unless you live in countries where internet is limited, and there are some of those out there.
How involved is the developer with the porting process? Do you just give them an EXE file and say, here you go? Or what other steps were you involved in?
The biggest main thing was making the tutorial language match the requirements. That was far and away the biggest thing that I had to do. I just gave them the project files. The only other thing we really had to discuss was adjusting the difficulty. It's a very challenging game, I'm sure you realize.
Right, of course.
They have their internal playtesters, and they contacted me and said, none of our playtesters can get past stage 2, so can we make it easier? So we added some health and lives, depending on the difficulty that you've chosen. We made it like almost kind of really easy on practice mode, because I may have said this on a previous episodes of this podcast, but practice mode on this game sort of works like certain games of the past, where if you choose easy mode, it's quite easy, but then the game will stop after a certain stage. Like, you can't play the whole thing. It'll end and you'll get a screen prompting you'll try the other difficulties.
Is that present in the console versions as well?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Did you feel like your vision was kind of being compromised with these changes, or did you think it was for the best?
I didn't think of it that way. I think it's perfectly fine. Playing on normal mode, adding one piece of health and 1 or 2 lives is not drastically going to affect the experience of the game. You still can't try again and again indefinitely from a checkpoint like you can with most modern platformers. You still have finite lives. If the lives run out, you still have to at least go back to the beginning of the stage. So no, not at all. I think it's still perfectly in line with what I hope for. I mean, the game is a lot more difficult than what I expected, frankly.
Did you have a sense of pride when you heard that, oh, the devs can't even get past level 2? Did you think, oh yes, this is exactly what I intended?
No. No, we've just been spoiled. I mean, it's been 30 years really since this type of game blueprint has been normal. So it's not really surprising.
Are there any plans for more languages in the future?
Not from me personally. I think, to be completely honest with you, I will have to see what the sales are like. I'm assuming that the publisher will be able to show me what the sales have been like in each country. Because I'm totally independent. It's literally right. Just me. So spending whatever it is, $100, $150, $200 on a translation, if it's not going to sell, it's just not really worth it for me personally. And really, you find that many, many gamers in non-English speaking countries can read English in video games. Right. I think. And also, I don't necessarily know that my future games are going to be as heavy on story.
I know it's been a year from the original release to the upcoming console release, but around how long did it take to port the PC version of Violet Wisteria from Steam to the Switch and PlayStation and Xbox once the actual process began?
It probably took me 2 months, I think, to switch out all of that language regarding controller naming. But once that was done, it really did not take them very long. They probably had the ports done not much more than a month.
Oh, that's interesting. I think.
And that's because of Game Maker Studio. It's just called Game Maker now, but it's incredibly friendly, yeah, with console porting.
Did you get to test the console versions during the porting process?
I have never played any of the console.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah, I am very curious as to what's going to happen. I think the footage in the East Asia Soft trailer, I believe that is from one of the console versions, most likely. Oh, okay. So I don't think there's any bizarre performance issues or anything like that. I mean, it's a game that does not push on the limits of modern technology at all. Yeah, but no, I have not actually played the ports myself.
Which console port do you plan on playing first when you get your hands on it?
I only own a Switch, so it's going to have to be the Nintendo Switch. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Are you excited to play it in handheld mode?
I've never played my Switch in handheld mode, no.
Oh, really?
I don't play games on the go. Maybe when I got my Switch, maybe I actually did play very briefly because I was still waiting to get a new TV, but yeah, no, really.
Yeah, we talked about it last year that, Violet Wisteria, you can play it on the Steam Deck. So ironically, it is a portable game, even though it was not your intention at all when you were making it. But now there are two portable devices that can play Violet Wisteria.
Technically speaking.
Do you know if the game can be played with one Joy-Con? Is that a challenge run you'd like to see?
I think one Joy-Con technically has all the same buttons, doesn't it?
It doesn't have the double triggers?
It doesn't have two?
I'm pretty sure it just doesn't have... It has left and right buttons. I think they're only called SL and SR, but only one E.
Well, then it wouldn't technically, because you can use the L and R, the front ones, to specify which attack you're using. And then R2, or whatever it is now, ZR, is Switch magic.
Okay. Looking back, would you have preferred to release Violet Wisteria last year on all platforms at the same time? Or do you think having it on Steam first, then consoles later, is more beneficial?
Particularly as a first-time developer, I think this is really the only way to go about it. If you're going to pitch to a publisher, they need to know that there's the potential to make money from this. The first thing they need to know is that you can make a game complete. There's a trillion people out there making games, but to make a game that is complete from start to finish and is commercially viable, there's a lot less people who do that or anything like that before, not even any experience in the industry. I think that it was the best idea to release on PC first and show that there is a complete game here that have the ability to take something to the end. But even if it doesn't sell a whole lot of copies, I think that you've got a calling card, something to show for yourself now. If I'm established in the future, it would be wonderful to release simultaneously. I think that is ideal. In a perfect world, I will definitely attempt to do that the next time. But yeah, I just was going in with nothing. This whole project was done on a prayer.
Violet Wisteria now has store pages on all the major platforms, and I'm looking at the eShop page on Nintendo.com right now. Was it exciting to see these store pages pop up, or did you use all your excitement when the Steam page launched last year?
It's pretty unbelievable, yeah. To see your own game on these major platforms. Yeah, it's really something.
Another unexpected place Violet Wisteria popped up on is Valis's Wikipedia page. Do you know the background about how Violet Wisteria got referenced on Valis the Phantasm Soldier's Wikipedia page.
I have no idea, but I wonder if maybe the person who reviewed it for a website called Rice Digital might have been the one to add it. That's the only thing that I can think of. That website previewed Violet Wisteria quite a while before the PC release. So they were one of the first places that really gave it a little bit of attention.
Hmm.
So then they gave it a full review after it came out. Yeah, so it might be them.
We didn't really talk about it, but of course, Violet Wisteria is heavily inspired by Valis. So to
heavily inspired by Valis. Yeah. It was initially going to be Valis 5.
So to have the official Wikipedia page on Valis mention Violet Wisteria is really awesome.
Yeah, absolutely.
What advice would you give to devs who have a game on Steam right now, but aren't sure how to get it on Switch and other platforms?
I will say that relatively, the bar to entry is very low now. The best thing that you can do is believe in your game and believe that it is worth playing, that it is as good as any other game, be it independently made or not. If you ask around, there are many, many, many opportunities to get your game published on home consoles. It might only be Switch. It depends. There are probably some different requirements. Some publishers may or may not be able to work with certain platforms, but polishing your creation, just ensuring that you've got something that has a clear start and finish. Once you're at that point, there are countless opportunities, I think. It's very easy to get your game published on a console, as long as you've worked, spent time getting the bugs out and that kind of thing.
What advice would you give to Switch gamers who are picking up Violet Wisteria for the first time?
I would say it's an incredibly unique game, and I hope you enjoy it. It's not a game made with the modern niceties. It does not really hit dopamine receptors. It's really old school. It's really about being stoic and overcoming your failures and that kind of thing. But the best thing about Violet Wisteria is that it's made in such a way where if you get comfortable with the play mechanic, generally you can by and large handle new situations that you've never seen just with reflexes. You don't have to memorize things for the most part. So I think in terms of the gameplay, that's one of the advantages that it has. But I would say enjoy. It's incredibly different from anything else out there right now. I mean, every week, hundreds of games get released. So it's just, they get drowned out. It's difficult to tell what the difference is. But I can say with 110% confidence that is drastically different from anything else being released on consoles right now.
Are there any plans for perhaps a physical version of Violet Wisteria in the future?
It would be wonderful. I would love that. It would definitely have to prove again that it is commercially viable, that there's enough interest that more than 500 people would be interested in buying a physical version, which is not easy. It probably seems easy from one perspective. Many small games get physical releases from Limited Run or whoever, but there are many, many other games out there. It's hard. That's one of the offsets about it, is that the bar to entry is relatively low now. If you've got some dedication, you can get your game out there. The flip side to that is there's countless other people who have the same intention. I personally think that the best idea would be to wait for our second game to come out and release it physically as a double pack. That would be more viable in terms of the amount of playability that people expect from a physical game. Like, for example, Joy Master's first two games, Oniken and Odalis, they eventually came out on a double pack. And it was actually published by East Asia Soft.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I'm aware they do physical editions of games. So maybe in the future, you never know. Is there
if Violet Wisteria sells however many thousand copies, it could be done. But frankly, I would probably be setting myself for trouble if I expected that.
Is there any sort of pack-in or a special item you'd like to include in a physical edition of Violet Wisteria?
Oh, man. Those things are so boring to me personally. I shouldn't say my real opinion on some of these things, man, because some of the things I think are so dissonant in relation to what modern gaming trends are. I really am just not particularly interested by all the trinkets that they put into the limited editions. Obviously, a soundtrack CD would be good.
You can always go the plushie route as well. Just put it in a plushie, the main character. That's enough for most people.
You could. I don't know which boss is going to end up being the most popular. I was thinking more almost something like a book, like a backstory, like something totally unexpected, like a religious text on the world, the higher realm, or something, like just do something very bizarre.
Before we wrap up, what's the future of Kanipro Games? Can you give us any details on your next game?
I have been working hard in secret, in a secret laboratory under the Earth's crust on our next title.
Under Japan.
Below Mount Fuji. So the next game is well underway. The game program itself is very far along. I've been hitting it pretty hard the past few months. I finally found people to do graphics, so we're just starting to get some of that stuff in place. Those things take quite a while, but I think it's a familiar genre with a major twist on it. And this time we have a new composer. I'm not going to quite reveal who the composer is right now. There's going to be a moment when that's appropriate, but it is a well-known person who has a bit of a cult following. They haven't done a soundtrack in a very long time, but they did make some music recently, and that's how I got a hold of them. And they're coming back out of retirement to do another soundtrack, and it's going to be big news when we reveal who they are.
That's exciting.
It is very exciting. I can tell you this. It's going to be a vertical shooter, and I'm sure you realize it's not going to be just a dodge and shoot. There's going to have to be some major twist to it.
All right. Well, that was a very thorough look at getting a game on the Nintendo Switch. So, Chris from Kanipro Games, where can people find you and where can people find Violet Wisteria?
Kanipro does technically have its own social media. I do have a Twitter account and even a YouTube channel for Kanipro. Before I started doing games under the name Kanipro, I also was sort of a YouTuber. I had some videos about old game reviews. So you can find me as Ultra Healthy Video Game Nerd on Twitter and YouTube. Violet Wisteria is already on PC and it's going to be on all modern consoles. So Nintendo Switch, PlayStation 4 and 5, Xbox Series SX, and Xbox One. Also, they release worldwide simultaneously March 13th, March 14th in East Asia and Japan.
And if the rumors that Switch 2 is going to be backwards compatible, it is, I guess, going to be available on Switch 2. Maybe we can announce that early.
Maybe. All those rumors.
No promises, but it is possible. You never know.
Yeah.
So awesome. And listeners, the links to everything will be in the podcast description, so check it out. Chris from Kanipro Games, once again, thanks for joining me.
Hey, thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
It's a very crowded game season right now. I'm still playing Side Order, still playing Balatro, and I'm even trying to clear some expert levels on Mario vs. Donkey Kong. But yet another game has entered the fray and grabbed my attention, Unicorn Overlord from Vanillaware. This game was announced in the September Nintendo Direct with the bold proclamation that the game is the rebirth of tactical fantasy RPGs. I'm still early in the game, so I can't definitively say it has completely brought the tactical RPG genre to its knees, and now we need to bow down to our new king. But Unicorn Overlord both wears its many inspirations on its sleeves, while also delivering something new and exciting. I feel like I should be a huge Vanillaware fan because of the detailed 2D art, but I haven't really played a lot of their games. I've played Motomasa, which rules, and now Unicorn Overlord. Odin Sphere and Dragon's Crown are perpetually on my I'll get to it someday list. Hey, by the way, Vanillaware, if you want to release Motomasa on Switch, I will play it. The game was announced only a few months ago, and now it's here. A far cry from 13 Sentinels, which seemed to be announced way before its release date, and then there was a year gap between the Japanese and US release, then a two-year gap from that release to the Switch version. It definitely feels like this game came out of nowhere, and I do feel that maybe there's not a lot of hype surrounding it, despite it being a very rare Vanillaware release, but maybe because it didn't have some long, drawn-out marketing cycle, that it feels like I haven't heard people talk about it as much compared to 13 Sentinels. I do prefer the, hey, our game comes out in 6 months marketing plan, opposed to the see you in 3 years type of announcement. Unicorn Overlord is a strategy RPG, but just saying that doesn't even scratch the surface of the many systems that the game employs. Fire Emblem plus Ogre Battle plus RTS is a fairly convenient shorthand. Like Fire Emblem, you move units into each other to initiate battle where you can see the expected outcome before the battle even starts, like how much damage you're going to do. And like Ogre Battle, you don't merely have one character, but instead you control several squads which are made up of characters on a grid. While the actual battles are turn-based, moving your units during the battle on the overworld is actually in real time. But you can pause the game, so don't worry. It is very much a gumbo of different games and ideas, but it does feel very coherent, albeit somewhat overwhelming at first. Unicorn Overlord definitely nails what makes strategy RPGs fun. You want unit customization, and you want to be able to use these units in interesting scenarios that suit their strengths. Each unit does have gear that you can equip, but the real strategy element comes from what squad they're in and how you arrange them. Each squad has two rows of three squares each, and it does matter where you put them. You might want to put a tank character guarding your archer, or you might want to deliberately not put your characters front to back because the enemy can hit both with one attack since they're a spearman, for example. The game does suggest some setups, but you'll likely learn more by trial and error and seeing the battles play out. Unlike Fire Emblem, where you select your attack before you initiate battle, here all the battles are automated. So which unit attacks who, when they use their healing spells, etc., is out of your hands. I'm not 100% convinced that this is for the best just yet, though. So far, the AI does seem to be smart, and battles do play out similar to what I would have selected, but it does feel odd to have all these options in a strategy game, but you can't actually affect the battles once they begin. You can use items before a battle starts, and units do have special abilities you can initiate on the field, but once a battle begins, it's out of your hands. And the game certainly has a lot of systems. There's everything I mentioned above, plus things like valor points that you use to deploy units or use abilities. Also, each unit has stamina that drains when you engage in battle, so you need to sometimes stop and regain stamina. And you can also take over forts and talk to characters on the field. There's definitely a lot going on each battle. Early on, you can just point your characters at the baddies and watch them mow down enemies, but after a few easy battles, you can get rocked if you aren't paying attention to your stamina or your squad build. I forgot to put an archer in one of my squads, and when I got to some griffin knights, whoops, I can't do any damage. You can change up your squad during battles at specific areas, but ideally you want to go in with the squads you want. I do like how the battles take place on the overworld. You're not warped to a separate area to fight, for example, like in Fire Emblem. There are also optional areas and things to engage with during a fight, and doing things like liberating a city or garrisoning a bridge does make it feel like an epic battle, and not just a few swordsmen swinging at each other. I do wonder if it's going to get overwhelming when I can control 8 squads, and the enemy has a dozen squads coming at me from all directions, but let's cross that bridge later. Your squads do start to feel more powerful once you recruit more characters and increase your squad size, so I'm really excited to see what kind of super powerful squads I can make in the future. And speaking of characters, there's a lot you can recruit, and the game has dozens of classes. You can also make generic characters that do have a surprising amount of flexibility. You can pick how their stats grow, their name, their hair color. It's not too dissimilar from hiring characters in Final Fantasy Tactics or making them in Disgaea, for example. You can also create some classes before you encounter a story character of the same class, and since later on in the game you probably will be controlling dozens of characters in a single battle, so it does encourage you not to just wait for a story character, and instead make who you want. When you're not battling, the other part of the game consists of overworld exploration. You're a little sprite on a big map, just like a classic JRPG. You can visit towns to buy stuff, upgrade your towns to buy more stuff, talk to NPCs, collect mats, do side quests, and so forth. Strategy RPGs have always struggled with the question, what should players do when they are not in battle? A tough 20 to 40 to maybe even hour-long battle does take a lot out of you, so I think maybe players aren't super eager to just jump into the next battle. They want a little downtime, an opportunity to rest and check on their units. Fire Emblem answered this quandary by introducing hub bases in between battles, but I think in the future they will likely introduce something similar to what Unicorn Overlord has. You don't have a home base per se, but there are plenty of safe areas to visit, while also enemies you can spot and engage with on the map at your leisure. The player can decide what they want to do and when, and the game has a good flow thanks to this freedom. As for the presentation, it's a Vanillaware game, so the game looks stellar with amazingly detailed animations. I will say that it is a bit tame in terms of character designs. I don't want to say they're generic, but they do look kind of like fantasy characters you've seen before. The main character is a blue-haired guy in knight armor. His best friend and rival has red hair. Your mentor is an old cavalry knight. Everyone kind of looks like what you'd expect them to. Compared to the more fantastical designs of Muramasa or Dragon's Crown, it does seem way more grounded than you'd expect from a Vanillaware game. I think the story could also be criticized the same way. Your prince whose kingdom is taken away, so you've got to raise an army to get it back. You have a cute girl who is your childhood friend. Again, your best friend is a fiery rival with the opposite color hair as you. I do wonder if there's some sort of twist or subversion down the line, because their previous game, 13 Sentinels, was very well regarded for its unorthodox and complex story. So to go from that to a more stereotypical save your kingdom fantasy tale is a bit surprising. I'm not super far into the game, though, so maybe I could just be completely wrong, and it actually makes Game of Thrones seem like a fairy tale in terms of emotional richness. We'll see. I feel like this is the easiest game in the world to at least recommend you try, because there is a demo, and the demo lets you play the full game for about 6 or 7 hours. That's a pretty absurd amount of time, and you'll definitely know if you gel with the game by that point. So there's really no reason to rush and buy it. Just download the demo and play that, and if you want more, get ready to plop down $60. If you like SRPGs, if you're a Fire Emblem fan, the demo is at least worth checking out. If it doesn't reinvent tactical RPGs, it at least gives a fresh take on the genre. I'll definitely talk about the game again on the podcast once I get some more hours into it, or when I beat it. And Vanillaware, please, let there be an actual unicorn class in this game. Okay, game time is up, now for the news. Remember Pokemon? They're back, and this time they're presenting things. We had our annual Pokemon Day Pokemon Presents video. The big announcement, of course, being a shocking one, a sequel to Pokemon Legends titled Pokemon Legends ZA. I think many of us expected another Pokemon Legends game, since the first one was so highly regarded and did sell well, but no one expected the next one to be set in Kalos. So many rumors were flying around about a possible Unova game, since Gen 5 is the oldest gen yet to be remade, and I even saw some Johto-related rumors, since that's a region we haven't visited in the longest time, but nope, we are returning to Kalos, to Poke France, in the latest Legends game. The video didn't show any gameplay, but it's described as taking place solely in Lumio City, and will focus on urban redevelopment to make it a better place for Pokemon and people. That's a very, very vague explanation, but let me take a shot at what the game is going to be about. The video shows both rough sketches of the city and also a futuristic 3D rendering. And since the title literally goes from Z to A, I think that maybe we will be able to bounce back and forth between the present and the past. So for example, something we do in the past, like creating a new building, will then be reflected in the future. At the very end of the trailer, we do get an overhead shot of Lumio City, which looks mostly the same as it's a big circle with 5 sections, but it's much more intricate than it was in XY. So I think some city builder elements will be present. Setting an entire Pokemon game in a single city is a really exciting and unexpected concept. Most RPGs in general should really just be set in a dense city instead of having a bunch of small towns and a big empty overworld. Final Fantasy VII Remake went with this concept, and the last section of Baldur's Gate 3 takes place in the titular city. Now, while Act 3 of Baldur's Gate 3 is not a whole game, it's about as long as one. Yo-Kai Watch also mostly takes place in a single city and the surrounding area, so it's not as limiting as you'd think. I'm sure there'll be an underground portion as well, and maybe you do get to explore the outskirts of the city, but keeping most of the game inside the city really gets me excited about how they're going to pull it off. I'm a huge fan of XY, and I even did an episode last year about XY's 10-year anniversary. Definitely go listen to that if you want to hear me and a guest gush about how great those games are. And we both agreed that Gen 6 would have a better reputation if there was a Pokemon Z. Well, this isn't Pokemon Z, but it's the closest thing we are going to get. Will Zygarde finally get justice? Will Az return? I mean, yes to both, right? They can really wrap up any lingering plot threads from XY and build on the lore of Kalos. The game comes out early next year, so thankfully it doesn't seem like Game Freak is just completely rushing the game to get it out the door this holiday. We don't have any notable Pokemon releases on the Switch this year, which is pretty shocking. I can't complain though, let them cook. They don't need to open the oven door when it's still preheating. Some are wondering, oh, will this come out on the Switch 2 simultaneously? I say, don't hold your breath for a native Switch 2 version, but again, we still don't know anything about the platform and how you will be able to play Switch games on it, so maybe there is a possibility there are two different versions at launch. But either way, I think this is now my new, most anticipated game. The Kalos Hive will rise up. Oh, and the other notable announcement is a Pokemon trading card game Pocket for mobile, which is a sort of truncated version of the TCG game. You get 2 free packs a day, and you can even battle with them in a special version of TCG Battles, more aimed at casuals. The current TCG client is pretty unusual since it's not really a game. It does feel like a digital companion app for people who played the physical card game. It's also US only, which is unusual for a game that comes from Japan. But this seems to be an easier entry point for people. I kind of wonder, is it going to be like a Pokemon version of Marvel Snap, which I would honestly love. I really don't think we're going to be building a 60 card deck either way. I'll definitely try it out, and let's see how addicted I get to it. Last bit of Pokemon news, the Tsutaya in Shibuya will open up a Pokemon card lounge on the 5th floor starting from April 25th. It looks like a trendy, adult-oriented cafe where you can play the Pokemon TCG. The site even says you can come empty-handed, and they will give you decks and other materials to play with. Plus, it also sells some exclusive merch. There is an admission fee, though, so it doesn't seem like you can just wander in there. And I do imagine there will be some sort of reservation system like other card game shops have. I do want to visit it, though, and maybe it's a future podcast feature. We're done with Pokemon, but let's stick to handhelds. The Wonderswan turned 25 years old last week. This is Bandai's Game Boy competitor that was designed by Gunpei Yokoi, the father of the Game Boy. Though it was only on the market for a few years, it also has many games from franchises that the Game Boy wasn't getting, like Final Fantasy. Bandai is releasing some Wonderswan merch, including keychains and t-shirts, for a limited time, so if you're listening to this podcast, you've got about a week. I definitely want to cover the Wonderswan as a feature in the podcast, too, in the future. Don't worry, I will never run out of subjects to talk about. Some more news, a Twitter user by the name of 12345678USJ recently tweeted out a map of the Donkey Kong Country expansion at Universal Studios Japan. It is the same map as the USJ app, so it's a cartoony rendition of the park. But even then, we still get to see some details like the minigame sections, not unlike the minigames in Super Nintendo World. There's also a stage where you can meet DK, plus Cranky, Dixie, and Diddy Kong also seem to appear in the park somewhere. One of the minigames seems to be some sort of bongo drum game with Rambi watching you, so it will be cool to see a real-life Rambi at least. I'm totally going to visit it, but I imagine Year 1 is going to be insanely crowded. I will at least try to cover it on the podcast this year, though, so fingers crossed. And last bit of news, some very, very sad news. Akira Toriyama, of Dragon Ball fame, has passed away at the age of 68. He's incredibly influential in the gaming sphere as the character designer for Dragon Quest, Chrono Trigger, Blue Dragon, and the upcoming Sandland. It's really impossible to overstate his influence. For example, if you look at the early Kensuke Mori designs for Pokemon, it looks like he is really imitating Akira Toriyama. Seriously, go back and look at the Gen 1 art and look at Akira Toriyama's art, and they're very, very similar. So he has a big footprint on the gaming world, even on games he didn't even work on. Again, it's really hard to overstate his influence on manga, anime, video games. I might want to cover him on the podcast in the future to pay tribute, so look out for that. Okay, we can wrap it up. Thanks as always for listening. Be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite app. Leave a 5-star review as well. It really helps with visibility. This podcast is also available on YouTube, so like and subscribe there as well. I'm on Twitter, Threads, Blue Sky, Instagram. Just search for Tokyo Game Life or find the links in the podcast description. If you like the podcast, be sure to share it with your friends and on social media. If there's anything you want me to talk about or cover, don't be shy. Just message me on Twitter. The next episode will be on March 24th. See you next time. Matane!